Good morning. This is Tracy Hales Bass with Right on Four Corners on KSJE 90.9 FM in Farmington, New Mexico. Today I'm talking with Patricia Walkow about her new book, New Mexico Remembers 9/11. Good morning, Patricia.
Good morning, Tracy.
Well, I was going to say enjoyed reading this, though I can't say it was enjoyable. It was brought up a lot of memories.
I think that's what it was supposed to do.
9/11 was one of those times in our lifetime where everybody knows what they were doing at that moment.
I think that is seared in people's brains.
I think so. So why don't you tell our listeners what New Mexico Remembers 9/11 is comprised of?
Okay. I'd also like to tell you how it came about.
Please,
if that's okay.
Yes, I was going to ask that too, so please.
On that day, almost 20 years ago,
mm-hmm.
I was on a business trip in Los Angeles. Fortunately, I had flown in the night before and had a rental car. And my husband was here at home in the Albuquerque area. And we wrote a story together about the days from September 11th to September 14th when I finally got home. And we alternated what I was doing on one day and then what he was doing on that day and then the next days. And we found it very helpful to ourselves to emotionally heal from that event. So a few years went by, and I had been mulling around for a while about perhaps doing some sort of an anthology of people's remembrances of 9/11. There's plenty of information for people who were at the attack sites, but there's really almost nothing from people who were not necessarily there physically, but that were still affected by it. So I came up with the idea of putting out a call for submissions for people to write their 9/11 memoirs with the stipulation that they must currently be living in New Mexico, and they must also be a writer.
Mm-hmm.
So I approached some local writing groups, not knowing if I was going to get many submissions or not. And if I didn't, I was going to expand it a little bit further out to other writing groups in the state. But as it turned out, I didn't need to do that. Just within the Albuquerque area, I got such a volume of submissions that I really did not need to go any further. And ultimately, I selected 25 stories and poems to put in the book. And I would like to tell you who the authors are, if you would indulge me for a minute.
Please do,
okay?
So. Yes.
There are 25 of us, so I'm going to go through this name list.
Good.
There's Joe Brown, John J. Candelaria, Pete Christensen, Teresa Civello, Brenda Cole, Mary E. Dorsey, Jesse Ehrenberg, Colin Patrick Enan, Roger Floyd, Ryan P. Freeman, Cornelia Gamlin, Paul D. Gonzalez, Loretta Hall, Joyce Herzog, Marilyn L. Pettis Hill, Rosemary Kern, Carolyn Kuhn, Gail Laura Dunn, Diane R. Layden, Elaine Carson Montague, Sylvia Ramos Cruz, Janet Ruth, myself, my husband Walter Walkow, and Dan Wetmore. So those are the authors who are in this book, which was published by Artemisia Publishing from Chihara.
I noticed all these people were from New Mexico now. They all had different takes on it. How did you pick which ones to include?
Well, as I read all the stories, I noticed that they sort of fell into five categories. One of the categories is, what do we tell the children? The other was taking care of business. In other words, people who were working in industries that were able to do something about 9/11 that day and beyond. People who were trying to make sense of the attacks. What it was like for people who were away from home. And then people who had reflections about what it all means. So as I read the stories, if the stories really fit well into those categories, I decided to select them. Now, just as a reminder, some of these people were not living in New Mexico at the time, but they had to be living in New Mexico to be in the book.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, one of the stories is a first-person account of someone who saw the whole thing.
Right.
Yeah, so it really runs the gamut. And one of the things I was wanted to, and I'm glad it happened, that I wanted to be sure was that I got the voices of some younger people who were still in school at the time. One of the stories is from a young man who was, at the time, a middle grade student, and another one was a freshman in college. So I think it was very important to get their voices in there also.
I noticed that, and I was glad of that.
I selected a few to read. I'm not going to read you the whole stories, of course,
mm-hmm.
but I'm going to tell you that the way the book is broken up is there is a very evocative poem written by one of the authors before each section. Okay, and the whole theme that I wanted to convey was that even though New Mexico is thousands of miles away from the three attack sites, we still felt attacked because it was the United States.
Exactly.
And I don't think in the popular media that you see on the TV shows of that day that enough acknowledgement is given to the fact that America was attacked. It happened to be in those three sites, but it was America that was attacked. So my first part of a poem I want to read is from Roger Floyd. Roger Floyd was fascinated with the blueness of the sky that day, and in fact, many times it was mentioned what a beautiful late summer, early autumn type day it was. So this is an excerpt from one of his poems, and the poem is called The Sky. The building high, the building low, the ground above, the ground below. Upon the earth the building lay. The sky, it seems, was blue that day. But blue, it seems, was not the kind that came to me and rent my mind and took from me the one I love, from ground below and sky above. I saw the sky that day, that fateful day, that fateful day. They came to die, and so did I. And there's more to the poem.
Yes.
But this leads off the entire book. The next excerpt I would like to read is from the author Marilyn L. Pettis Hill, and it is called A Mother's Heart. And it is about her son, who at that time was grown, and he was in the service. And she was going to Raleigh, North Carolina, to see him deploy, but she had no idea where he was going. All right, this is Marilyn speaking. I flew to Raleigh, North Carolina, and he picked me up at the airport. I hugged him so tightly I thought I would squeeze the life out of him. We talked as we drove to Fort Bragg. He still would not tell me where he was going, and he talked in generalities. When he arrived at my hotel, the young registration clerk asked me where I was from. Albuquerque, New Mexico, I replied. Really? He exclaimed in shock. I thought, I knew I should have taken a left turn at Albuquerque. It was only a Bugs Bunny cartoon thing. It's a real place, I replied. He asked what I was doing at Fort Bragg, and I told him my son was getting ready to ship out. He said, oh, yeah, the 82nd is deploying to Afghanistan. I turned and looked at my son with incredulity. He just shrugged nonchalantly. When he took my luggage to my room, I asked, how is it that the hotel registration clerk knows where you are going and I don't? He shrugged again and said, the people around Fayetteville and Fort Bragg seem to know everything that happens on base. So much for military intelligence, I thought. But I was grateful this almost all-knowing registration clerk had alerted me. Of course, this knowledge brought up a plethora of additional questions. My mama always said I was a nosy child. Well, there is certainly a time and place for over-the-top curiosity. I wanted to know where in Afghanistan and how long and. Being who he is, my son just said, Mama, you know I can't tell you. Leaving Fort Bragg was one of the hardest things I had ever done. My only child was going to war. This is the child I prayed for and begged for. This is the child I thought I would never have. And then there's more to the story, of course.
It's very touching.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And there are a lot of very touching stories in the section called what do we tell the children?
Yes.
It was a huge dilemma for people as to just how much to tell their children, what to expose them to, what to hide them from. You know, there's another story by Carolyn Kuhn. That story is called That Day. And in the story, I'm not going to read it to you, but in the story, there is a scene where a few days after the event, her son Cole had built a tower of blocks, possibly Legos, and he was flying airplanes into them. And, of course, that disturbed Carolyn, and she's decided that they needed to be more careful to what they exposed him to.
Right.
That's another very touching story. So another part of the book is called Taking Care of Business. You know, they were people whose jobs really were able to let them do something about what was going on. In fact, Joe Brown, who worked for the U.S. Air Force at Edwards Air Force Base in California at the time, he has a story called At Least I Could Do Something About It. And the story goes into military readiness of defending our country and preparing for what would ultimately be war. But I'd like to read you his closing paragraph. On 9/11, I was devastated by the loss of innocent lives on our soil. We will never know, but I believed then, and still do today, that we likely could have avoided the tragedy. We must always be able to keep track of the people and organizations posing a threat to our freedoms and nation. On September 11, 2001, we knew, in general, who they were. But because of previous cuts in funding, we did not have the resources to keep constant track of their activities. We have now addressed this problem since then. Sadly, for thousands of people, the victims of that day and their loved ones, the correction came too late and at far too high a price.
That was astounding to read that.
Yes. There's another one from the section called Taking Care of Business. It's called Grounded by Rosemarie Kern. Now, Rose Kern was an air traffic controller.
Right.
So she was really in the thick of things, getting the airplanes down and dealing with people who were calling air traffic control locations to say, I need to fly, I need to get home to my mother or whatever. And it wasn't much she could do other than say, take ground transportation, which was very difficult to come by after a few hours. But she has a quote in her book, which I think is a testament to how well the air traffic control system worked and all the people in it. She says, luckily, the weather was good over most of the country, but it still took hours to get the airplanes all down and parked somewhere, anywhere. So her story is a very, very interesting one.
I didn't remember or think about the impact of all the planes being grounded.
All the planes were grounded, and all the rental cars were in places where they shouldn't be. Fortunately, I had a Hertz rental car, and I was able to get home because I tried Amtrak, and their system crashed, so I could not get back by Amtrak from L.A. to Albuquerque. I never got through to Greyhound. And as I said to my husband, I have a car, I'm driving. You know, I'm very glad I did. It was really difficult. We also have a very beautiful poem from a poet and artist. But her poet is called Counting Backward Toward Before.
I love that one.
And the whole gist of the story is that all the devastation has occurred, and we are going now backwards in time until everything is just as it was. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but I'll read some of it.
Great.
Okay. This is Janet Ruth's poem. We bring back the troops, put down missiles and rifles, withdraw fearful, suspicious stares from fellow humans on planes, in public places, Middle Eastern faces that could be Moses or Jesus or Muhammad. Watching television, tears roll up our cheeks, hands uncover our faces. On a morning like any other, we return to what we had been doing, eating breakfast, morning exercises, getting in the car to drive to work. And the Twin Towers swallow smoke and flames. People run backward into coffee shops, sit down to newspapers folded open, mugs of cooling latte. They jog backward to catch taxis. They slowly reverse the day. As the cloud of dust and smoke is sucked back into the ground, as the towers, first responders back out, remove their gear, people walk back into buildings, help each other up stairwells, sit down at their desks, take a moment to call husband or wife or child to say, I love you, and I'll see you tonight for dinner. Fingers click on keyboards. And the poem goes on for a few more stanzas.
I thought that was very poignant.
My hat is off to poets. They can say in just a few words what others have more difficulty saying.
Absolutely.
With many more words.
It's true. It's true. And that one really says a lot.
I would like to read from one of the youngsters at the time on September 11th, 2001, from Ryan P. Freeman, who was in middle school at the time.
That's a good one.
Yes, he had awakened that day, and there was kind of commotion in the downstairs. I mean, things were different. So I'm going to start with, he's a kid, he's in middle school. He says, now crunching on breakfast, I pulled up my dusty memories. Maybe it was from Die Hard 2. Unsure, I continued eating and watching television, transfixed with the rest. Medusa herself could not have paralyzed my family any better. As I ate, I began waking up in earnest, a trait I still keep today. In retrospect, what happened next probably only spanned the course of no more than 15 minutes. In a quarter hour, one age would end and another would begin. Our entire zeitgeist would fade before the arrival of another. Those who have been born after won't understand. Before, the power going out was exciting. Now, not so much. Before, when planes were in the news, it was some accident. Things righted themselves. The sun shone. Things were still generally good and right. I can't tell you how I knew, but I did. That is a small reading from Ryan's work.
It's interesting how so many people in here mention that they now have PTSD.
Yes, after all these years, some of them still have it. My sister-in-law, Jeannie, was, I thought she was still working in the World Trade Center at the time, but she wasn't. She was at One Liberty Plaza, which is next door, and she was there and saw all the people jumping out and was filled with all the debris. It took a toll out of her. I have another story called September by Mary E. Dorsey, and this was something I did not know, that in one of the World Trade Center buildings, there was a yellow lab called Sirius, S-I-R-I-E-S, and it is Sirius's story. I'm going to read to you from Mary Dorsey's story.
Okay.
There is one name missing from that memorial. She's referring to the memorial at the World Trade Center. That name is Sirius. He was a four-year-old yellow lab, a member of the K-9 unit. He, along with his handler, David Lim, worked for the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey. They were explosive detectors. On that fateful Tuesday morning, they were in the basement office in the South Tower when the first plane hit. David put Sirius into his kennel and went to check what was happening and what he could do to help. As he left the office, David said to his partner, the dog, I'll be back for you. David, along with six firemen and an injured woman, got trapped by debris in one of the tower's lower floors. It took nearly 5 hours for them to be found and rescued. Thankfully, they all survived. But it was too late for Sirius. He had perished when the towers fell. It took nearly 4 months to find his remains. When they were discovered, he was still in his kennel. On January 22nd, 2002, a still heartbroken David kept the promise he had made to his partner. He carried his beloved Sirius's body, which was draped in the American flag, out of his tomb and into the daylight. K-9 Sirius was given a police hero's farewell, complete with bagpipers and a 21-gun salute. So we have non-human victims
also.
Oh,
yes. Yeah, that was a touching story, too.
Yes. I have a story from Cornelia Gamlin. It's called One Happy Island. She was away from home when the events happened. She was on a vacation in the beautiful island of Aruba. This is an excerpt from her story.
Okay.
On the beach in Aruba, we met other Americans from New York, D.C., and elsewhere. This brought us some solace and feeling of unity, but we couldn't escape the anxiety, the feeling of being cut off. Smartphones and tablets weren't yet part of our everyday lives. There was another complicating factor. Aruba's government controlled the island country's telecommunications. It was difficult and expensive to make calls to the outside world. With air traffic suspended, there was a collective uncertainty about when and how we'd get home. Not a bad place to be stranded, people would say to us later. On the contrary, it was. I just wanted nothing more than to be home, even if fighter jets were eerily patrolling the empty skies over the nation's capital. So,
that was
paradise, I guess,
right.
Is what you make it.
Exactly.
Another one I have in the reflection section of the book is by a man who was in college at the town.
Oh, yeah.
His name is Colin Patrick Enan, and his story is called A Guilty Memory. And his whole gist of his story was that he was annoyed that people were so upset and falling apart. I'm going to read from his.
Okay, good.
He was on campus. He says, campus was eerie, a ghost town, if you'll pardon the cliche. It's a little too quiet. It was funny how the human brain lacks the ability to quantify some things before experiencing their dearth. For example, out there, it should have been a constant drone of footsteps and chatter, some laughter tossed in, the occasional salutatory greeting. Instead, it was quiet. I remember hearing the buses more than anything. They'd always been present as part of the background buzz. But that morning, they roared, running their normal routes, many devoid of passengers. Visually, it was a similar story. Lines of sight opened, and I saw patches of grass, bushes, benches, trash cans I'd never spotted before, there being no packs of sorority girls or fraternity bozos blocking the view. In short, it didn't feel like a campus boasting 40,000 students. Anyway, he goes on that through his story, talking about his many years feeling a little bit guilty that he wasn't so distraught, but he really was, but just in a different way.
Exactly.
And he ends his story with an interesting set of words. He says, anyway, if there's one thing definitely not on the cherished wish list, it's psychological growth. And 20 years later is better than never.
That was a good one, too. I'm glad that was included because it did show that people reacted differently.
You know, some people said to me, I'm afraid to say this, but the terrorists really did have a brilliant plan. And I happen to agree with them. They did have a brilliant plan. And I don't think there's anything wrong with saying that. It just doesn't, you know, mean that they should have done it. Well, I think people were disbelief, anger, fear, and everyone had some of that to a greater extent than others.
Right.
And for my final reading, I'd like to read to you the final poem in the book by Dan Wetmore. It's called The Crucible. It says, the stars and stripes, as somber shroud, we view through tears, which vision clouds. 3,000 lives torn from our hands, but where they lie, our memory stands. And builds resolve where towers once grew, with hopes to make the world new. To see all neighbors in a mirror, hate only hate, our vision clearer. That those who died, not mourned in vain, lifting us in their wake, above mortal plane. So there's a sampling from New Mexico Remembers 9/11 in both ebook and paperback.
And it has some great photographs in there.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the publisher and I went through a lot of photos to find ones that we thought really fit each story mm-hmm. quite well.
And
yes.
I think this is a really important book because I think that we need to make sure everybody remembers.
Well, it's interesting that in 20 years when we were so united, what has happened, and it seems that in this particular day and age and in this awful year of 2020, that we have become so divided. It's a stark contrast.
Well, I noticed one of the stories talking about the abundance of flags, and I remember flags everywhere, and that's not really happening anymore.
No one was ashamed to show the flag.
Right.
And I'm sorry that people are, and I just think there are many people perhaps not traveled enough or have not lived in regimes that are so repressive that they don't understand how relatively really good we have it in this country. I hope that this book can bring some closure to some people who are still having trouble and perhaps even encourage them themselves to write something about that day. Because people are still hurting from it.
They are.
And it was an honor for me to read some of the deepest thoughts of the writers and for sharing them with me. Writing puts you out there emotionally, and it's not for the faint of heart.
It must have been difficult at times to put this together.
It was difficult in that, especially being a native New Yorker myself, especially to me, the images of the World Trade Center buildings collapsing has become the iconic image, and it's painful for me. However, if you look at the cover of the book, originally, we tried different covers, and originally it was just one of the lights to stand in for the two towers with the New Mexico flag in the corner, and I made sure that the other two sites were represented, because it wasn't just New York that was attacked. So the cover has the beautiful illuminated benches at the Pentagon for each life lost there. It has the Freedom Tower at the fields in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. And, of course, it has the Beams of Life at the World Trade Center site. I wanted to be sure that all three sites were remembered.
Yes.
One of the interesting things I found when editing the stories was that a writer would write a statement and they'd say, United 93 was headed for the White House. There is absolutely no proof of that that we have. But it has been said so many times in the media for 19 years that people come to believe what they hear. So I had to do some real fact-checking, and instead we say it was suspected that United 93 was headed for the White House or the Capitol, but nobody really knew. But there were many instances of where just common usage of ideas became, in the writer's mind, became facts that had to be validated.
Very true.
That happens to this day. You know, you hear it enough, you believe it.
Right.
Well, I wanted to have it published this year in preparation for next year's 20th anniversary of the event. So that's why I wanted it published this year. And I do hope people pick it up and it helps them get through those events. And for those who were kind of young at the time and don't remember much about it, it will give them a pretty good idea of what of how people reacted.
I mean, you're getting into the personal stories and the personal feelings rather than just news report.
I know with myself and my husband, I was so focused on when I'm going to leave Los Angeles, how I'm going to get home, you know, can I return the rental car without a charge, all that. I was so busy making my plans that I didn't really have a moment of grief until I was on that stretch of U.S. 40 coming east through Arizona, where you have Monument Valley to the north, Painter Desert to the south, and George Bush was speaking at the National Cathedral, and he gave a beautiful speech. He was never the most eloquent of speakers.
Right.
But that speech was so touching, I had to pull over, and I really just broke down and cried. My husband, on the other hand, I realized he had the much harder job waiting at home. You know, he works for Sandia Lab, so, you know, they closed shop for a while. So it was harder for him, I think, than it was for me.
Well,
I hope people enjoy the book.
Okay.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you, Tracy.
And that was Patricia Walkow talking about her compilation of essays and poems, New Mexico Remembers 9/11. This is Tracy Hales-Vass with Right on Four Corners on KSJE, the cultural beacon of the Four Corners.